Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, you are very welcome to The Tonight Show. Tributes are paid to veteran journalist and broadcaster Charlie Bird, who has died after a long illness. As RTE correspondent, Charlie Bird covered most of the biggest stories in Irish life in recent decades. The president described him as an exceptionally talented broadcaster driven by a deep sense of social justice.
He never stayed, went off focus. The focus was to try and get the story, to find out what the truth was in a story. And he did it so well, and people really, really connected with him. He had an incredible connection.
Also on the programme, we speak to a journalist from news website The Ditch about the publication of the Attorney General's advice on the eve of the referendums. And we ask if moratoriums are still fit for purpose. And we're live to New York, where British former socialite and convicted sex offender Ghislaine Maxwell seeks to overturn a 20-year prison sentence. Well, the president has led tributes to veteran former RTE correspondent and broadcaster Charlie Bird, who has died at the age of 74 following a long battle with illness. As correspondent with RTE, Charlie Bird covered many of the biggest news stories in Ireland and internationally in a career stretching 40 years. In 2021, he confirmed his diagnosis of motor neuron disease and went on to raise millions for charities and raise awareness about the condition. Here's just a taste of some of the stories he covered in his extraordinary journalism career.
We're now in the heart of Ground Zero, where once the Twin Towers stood.
Mr. Drum, it's Charlie Bird from RTE. Can I talk to you? There are taxpayers at home in Ireland who would like some answers.
Here at the Stardust Club in Artane, the work of sifting through the debris has been going on all day. The government inquiry into the fire will have to examine a number of important issues.
Just 2 days ago, a short distance from where I'm standing, two British soldiers were killed in a booby-trap bomb. Early in the morning, that powerful earthquake, and then a short time later, the massive tidal wave, which caused such death and destruction.
Charlie Bird, RTE News, in Ground Zero.
Well, joining me to discuss his life and legacy are former RTE broadcaster Sean O'Rourke, Ireland editor with the Irish Independent, Fionnán Sheehan, Stardust campaigner Antoinette Keegan, and public relations consultant and lead organiser of The Climb with Charlie fundraiser Paul Allen. And we're also joined down the line by RTE's former Washington correspondent Katrina Perry, who is now chief presenter with BBC News US. You're all very welcome to the programme. Sean, to come to you first, because he was a colleague, but he was also a friend. Why was Charlie Bird so important to you?
First of all, because he cared. He cared about me. He cared about everybody else in the newsroom. He cared about the stories we were doing. He cared about getting them right. He had tremendous instincts as a journalist. I mean, in those early clips from one of the first big stories he covered, the Stardust, he was doing a piece to camera asking the relevant question, were the exit doors locked? And that was the essence of Charlie. He got to the heart of the news story or whatever he was doing. He was also, he was a tremendous human being. I mean, that became very evident and very obvious in the latter years when he, supported by Claire and their and his daughters and their kids, they fought that heroic battle very publicly when he was dealing with motor neuron disease. So, you know, he was a very rounded individual. He was great fun. He was great to go for a drink with. He was great to go for coffee with in the canteen, you know, have a bit of a gossip with her and at her. He didn't take himself seriously. He took his work very seriously. And yes, I mean, there were times when he was under tremendous strain. I think particularly of that 28-day trial in the High Court, the libel action taken by Beverly Flynn arising out of the reports that he and George Lee did on National Irish Bank. He put huge effort into everything he did, particularly to take something like National Irish. I mean, there were two big stories there. One about a scheme for investing money abroad and bringing it back, a tax evasion thing. And the other one where National Irish were literally dipping into the accounts, the savings of their customers. And Charlie spent endless hours putting that story together and getting it right.
Was that, do you think, the most important scoop of his career?
Oh, look, he actually said himself, the most important, the day that gave him most satisfaction was the day he reported on Queen Elizabeth in Parnell Square in the National Garden of Remembrance, because it kind of brought to an end, if you like, the story that he had worked on so assiduously. I think by far, in terms of the national importance, would have been his dealings with the Republican movement, the way he tracked the movement towards the manoeuvring towards the ceasefire in August of 1994. But again, internationally, I mean, you know, you name the country, you name the trouble spot, Charlie was there, whether it was Rwanda, whether it was Haiti, South America, the Middle East. There were just so many times when he was at the heart of it. A particular piece of work that I worked with him on that I took a lot of satisfaction on. I was editing this week, the Sunday radio programme, and Charlie was out in the mountains between Iraq and Turkey, where the Kurds were fleeing from Saddam Hussein after they had been let down. They had been promised American support if they rose up against Saddam, and the Americans were nowhere to be seen when the going got rough. And Charlie was there with Father Jack Finucan from the Concern Aid Agency. And the report that he sent back later on a Saturday evening, we worked pretty much into the night to get it edited. It was a wonderful, wonderful word picture, full of actuality and human drama that told a great story on radio, even though he was probably better known as a TV reporter.
I mean, he had a certain tenacity, didn't he? And a certain chutzpah. You can see that by how he got into journalism. I think he was working in a pub and he lobbied some journalists who frequented the pub to give him a start.
He blagged his way into the Irish Times library, I think it would be true to say. And then he was working in Charlie Chalk's there, what's now the Goat Grill, there in Goatstown. And people like Donald Foley, the late news editor of the Irish Times, Owen Harris was there. I think Owen Harris can be credited with bringing Charlie Bird into RTE and encouraging him. And Charlie had that, like, he had the endless appetite for news. He was endlessly curious.
He could be seen at times, Sean O'Rourke, as being, you know, a bit innocent, couldn't he? But that innocence was almost disarming, you'd say. That was a real quality.
He retained the capacity to be shocked in a way that maybe more cynical people mightn't. And they might shrug their shoulders and say, oh, well, you know, that's the way they do things. Well, Charlie would say, well, why is that the way they do things? You know, why should they be allowed to do that? I got a message from somebody today saying, look, you know, a text from a person who said, look, you know, when I was growing up, you know, we were shushed if Charlie was on the news reporting something as kids. And, you know, people felt he was their reporter. He was there asking the questions that the people wanted answers. And he didn't easily take no for an answer.
Antoinette, we're often, I think, told as journalists, you know, don't become emotionally involved in the story. And yet, when it came to Stardust, he did become emotionally involved. He was the first reporter on the scene that night, Valentine's night, back in 1981, when your two sisters died and when many others were killed. And I think it's quite remarkable that his last public appearance was at a vigil to mark the 43rd anniversary of Stardust. There was, in truth, a real bond there, wasn't there, between journalist and story.
There was, and Charlie was always, it was always very close to Charlie Board's heart, right? The emotions and the way that he performed, right, helping us, right, and that he was always there for us, right, and insofar as, right, even going as far as Derry with us, like the Bloody Sunday, supporting us every step of the way along the journey and unveiling three memorials. Like one that was put up in 2018, there was three victims' names spelt wrong. And Charlie, when we rang him to ask him at the unveil, he was honoured. Like, he just couldn't believe it. Like, you know, that he was getting the privilege of unveiling the plaque where he done the news reported the first journalist to be there on the scene of the Stardust that night. And he was honoured to unveil that. But then when we had to take that down and put the new one up with all the names spelled right, again, right, he was honoured and delighted. And he came along very proudly with his wife, Claire. And then the new memorial wall we just got up last year. And we got his name on it as well, unveiled by Charlie Bird with his photograph. He was actually crying that day. Like, it's very emotional.
And he's an emotional person at all,
isn't he? Yeah, he is. Yeah, and he's always been very emotional towards the Stardust, right? And all the families. He's at their, like, you know, a very, very special bond has been, like, there for each and every one of the families of the 48 victims. In so far as, right, that Charlie, like, his dearest wish was that he wanted to be at the candlelight vigil. And the next wish that he had was that he wanted to be at the last day of the inquest to hear the verdict. But though he won't be there, we know that he's going to be there in spirit.
And I just want to go to Katrina Perry there, because as Sean pointed out, at times journalism can be a little bit cynical. I think we would all admit to that, unfortunately. But he does seem to have come at stories with a certain energy and passion and excitement that you don't always find with people who've been in the industry for a very long time. Was he generous with the story, Katrina Perry, when he did get that scoop?
Yeah, I mean, I suppose my first encounter with Charlie Bird was as a teenager. I mean, he was reporting on RT News for the entire time that I'd been alive. And then I found myself on work experience in the newsroom. And it was the 1997 presidential election, just dating myself there. But, you know, I'd been told to fax tally sheets to stringers. That's the way we used to do things. And I was trying to figure out, how do I work this fax machine? You know, I'm here in RT newsroom full of all the Galacticos. And next thing, Charlie Bird comes up to me, seeing that I was lost, kind of not knowing what to do. Can I help you? And there was this individual, one of the top journalists in the country, busy at the time, about to break the NIB story, the IRA's go-to person in the Republic of Ireland at the time, and took time to help the little work experience girl, me, figure out how to work the fax machine and send these tally sheets out to the stringers and all the count centres a couple of days before the presidential election. So he was incredibly, Sean used the word caring there, he was incredibly caring and kind. And, you know, for those of us who were the younger, more junior colleagues, he did always look out for you. He always would have a kind word for you. And he was so energetic and enthusiastic and childlike at times, and his kind of dogged pursuit of a story. He was ruthless in the pursuit of a story, which made him such a great journalist. But he would always stop to make sure that the younger colleagues were, you know, looked after or shared a kind word, and conscious that we were looking up to him as the star of the RT newsroom.
To go back to you, Fiona, Katrina mentioned there that he was this point of contact in RT for the IRA. How did that come about, and how significant was that relationship?
It dated back quite some decades to the early parts of his career and coverage of the Troubles. And it did become a point where, you know, there was a joke around in RTE. What was the IRA's password when he used to ring Charlie, when they used to ring RTE, and it was, is Charlie there? And, you know, he took it very seriously, though. He was a point of contact. He obviously realised that any messages that were being relayed were very, very serious. It was a very tense time. And we did have that period where there was a long and sustained period where we were building up towards a ceasefire, and any word that was coming through was kind of being parsed and analysed. And, you know, once it was important as well for the audience at home, once they heard that Charlie Bird, who was somebody who they knew and that they trusted, that this word was coming through about the ceasefire, that then there was a particular significance to it. And you have to remember, obviously, RTE had troubled times through the period of Section 41 and censorship, and the fact that you couldn't actually relate
anything that was being said by a directly by a terrorist organisation. And Charlie Bird did, in effect, have to translate what was happening for the public at home.
To move on, Paul Allen, to the, I suppose, second part of his life, the second chapter, and that was that diagnosis in 2021 with motor neuron disease. I think he first noticed this change in his voice. That's what's concerned him. Mm. He was brave and he was stoic. But any interviews or any time I saw him speaking about it, I did feel that initially, certainly, he was haunted by that diagnosis.
Yeah, but he was a very determined man. And if I may begin by just expressing my deepest sympathy to Claire, Nasa and Orla and the grandchildren in relation to Charlie passing. He was just very determined. He certainly was the bravest man I ever came across. Because in dark days, he disappeared for 2 weeks. He sent me the message that I'll always remember. And he disappeared for 2 weeks and then he came back bounding with energy. Let's do something. Let's turn a negative into a positive and reach out. He reached out to people who were having difficult times. And the idea of a mountain was that people are dealing with difficult issues on a daily basis. This was their mountain and this is the mountain he was going to climb. And he was climbing his own mountain in the context of what was going on.
But he was honest, I think, wasn't he? About death, about what he faced, about his struggles, about leaving his families, about the emotion of it all.
Absolutely. And with Charlie is that you never really get a second chance to talk to him. It's a yes or no. He's coming at you at 35,000 feet and you better believe it. So he doesn't understand the word no. He's permanently on the gas in terms of he doesn't stop on the brakes and he was pushing and pushing. And the climb of Charlie, there was 200 locations around. And just in terms of 3.6 million Charlie raised for the two great charities, and it was phenomenal. But just it gives an example of how determined he was and how focused he was. And really, he had his checklist. And when he finished with Climate Charlie, the next morning he was up, I want to talk to the Samaritans. I want to do something with these people. And then he reached out to Brent Pope. Brent Pope had a project involving the elephant in the room. He was very much behind that. He got the President of Ireland to sign the elephant. He was raising money for another charity and he was go, go, go. And it's kind of poignant in many ways because we're coming up to the anniversary of Climate Charlie in early April. But my goodness, we'll never forget Charlie Bird.
You spoke to him 3 weeks ago.
Yes.
Had he made his peace with his diagnosis and the end that he faced?
Well, I think as soon as he realised way back, he was very much at peace and was very much committed to doing better. And I think the projects that were going on were certainly keeping Charlie alive because he was buzzing every day in relation to that. But after COVID, he was out trying to do things. That's how the Climate Charlie became such a passionate project after the COVID break. People were very much jumping up and down to be part of something. And we had to kind of dampen it down. We had the mountain climber, Pat Falvey, telling people, be careful, you're climbing a mountain, it's serious. But the symbolism was such a powerful one for Charlie to get across.
It was Katrina Perry, you know, a stellar career. We're discussing it here. But there was, of course, like all long careers, there were low points. And I think he has written himself and admitted that being in Washington as the Washington correspondent was a low point for him. You obviously became Washington correspondent. Do you understand, having spent time there, having had the role yourself, why he struggled?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I don't want to speak for Charlie, but he did write about it in his book and in many interviews. I think he said that he had been mad to take the job. And when I got the job, he did, you know, he wished me well and congratulations. And he kind of said, you know, you're much younger than I was. And that's better. You'll be better. You'll enjoy it more. Because I think he felt coming into this city that, you know, he was used to a different type of lifestyle in Ireland. Everyone knew him. Everyone knew RTE. If there was a story, you called Charlie Bird with it. And then you come into a much bigger place here and people haven't heard of RTE. Some people don't even know that Ireland is a different country to the UK. And so it was a very different set of circumstances. And, you know, he had a lot going on in his personal life at the time. He'd just met his lovely Claire that he went on to marry. He'd just become a granddad. So he had a lot going on in Ireland that was more important to him than any job would ever be. But, you know, he was always very supportive of me and colleagues who've had the role in RTE after me. Because, you know, we always say, and I know Sean will go along with this as well, RTE is a family. There's highs and lows and good parts and bad parts like there are in any family, but ultimately everyone looks out for each other and everyone is pulling in the same direction. And, you know, Charlie embodied that no more than anyone else did.
What some people mightn't know, Fionnuala, was there was also a flirtation with politics from when he was very young in his life to that period, actually, when he was in Washington, when he wrote in his book that he actually had approaches from Fine Gael and met Fine Gael, who were trying to coax him to run for a seat in Dublin.
Yeah, and ultimately he might have ended up going down the George Lee route as well.
I think he actually said it was him, wasn't it, who suggested to Fine Gael that they should talk to George Lee.
I mean, Charlie was, you know, he was quite the radical in his younger days, involved particularly with the Labour Party. And in the fiery days back then when party conferences were not as staid and set PC and boring as they are now, Charlie Bird was up on the stage and the firebrand was there. So that's where the deep social conscience came from, his political background. And he also, you know, he added to politics. He could infuriate the political correspondents in Leinster House in terms of his coverage of politics sometimes. But he also added, you know, a great public interest. I mean, he can be partially credited with Bertie Ahern becoming the Taoiseach because he covered Bertie's tour in 97. And Bertie's bus was going around the country and Charlie Bird was leaping off the bus at every occasion.
The crowd was whipped into a frenzy
because Charlie Bird was covering it.
And he got into a bit of a frenzy about that in a very unfair way towards another one of our colleagues. I mean, the fact is Bertie did a barnstorming campaign. I mean, it didn't matter who was coming off the bus or jumping off the bus. John Bruton, God rest him, was perhaps a bit more traditional in his type and he just didn't have Bertie's energy or his...
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Capacity and
but they were worried that it sort of came across as an endorsement.
And I think for the subsequent election, Charlie was swapped around from one campaign to another. But look, I don't think he influenced events so much as reported on them.
He definitely reported, but he brought the audience in. That was the great capacity that he had. Whatever story he was covering, and particularly those he had a passion for. He really did draw in an audience, and a story was made all the more significant because Charlie Ward was covering
it. Was there a danger there, though, Paul Allen, in journalists who are objectively covering news stories and political events, entertaining approaches from political parties?
Sure, but it's a nice form of flattery, isn't it? I'm sure Sean is still enjoying it in terms of
I'm still waiting for the flattery, but however...
I was just about to start.
The approaches, Sean.
No, but in the context of what was going on, of course it was, and Charlie was fantastic. He was just a magnet and he enjoyed it and people enjoyed it and he was just one of these icons that we, you know, sadly have lost.
Yeah, I just wonder, Katrina mentioned there that, you know, RTE is a family and he very much was part of that. Did he speak to you about the recent scandals that we've seen in RTE at all?
No, I mean, we met, I think the last time I talked to him was just after Christmas. I've called to his house. There was a group of us, we call ourselves the West Away Group. It was a WhatsApp group, the seven of us, old soldiers, people like Tommy Gorman, Jim Fahey, God rest him, Ray Burke, who was head of news gathering, Joe O'Brien, Michael Lally, and we met in Salt Hill. We'd walked to prom and then into the city centre, have a meal. And, like, the walk got slower every time we did it because people were just, I won't say mobbing Charlie, but he was approached by so many people wanting to wish him well, thanking him for his fundraising efforts and just wanted selfies with him. I mean, I remember having a discussion with Sam Smith in the Dáil Bar late one night, many years ago, and we were talking about Charlie Bird's merits as a journalist as opposed to, shall we say, Mr. Household Name. And I said, but, you know, how do you distinguish him? He says, Mr. Household Name is just a household name. Charlie Bird is a star.
Did he enjoy that? Did he enjoy
absolutely.
That attention?
He loved it.
Did
he fed
the
off
star?
It.
He did
yeah,
feed
yeah,
off
absolutely,
it.
Absolutely, absolutely.
All right, look, we're going to have to leave that discussion there for now. But my thanks to Antoinette Keegan, to Katrina Perry and to Paul Allen. My other guests are staying with me. And we do, of course, want to extend our own deepest condolences to Charlie's wife, Claire, his daughters, Orla and Nasa, and to his wider family. Now, after the break, we'll be discussing the leaking of the Attorney General's advice to the ditch. Stay with us. You're very welcome back. Well, last Thursday, the day before the polls opened on the referendums, and just as the media moratorium came into place, preventing broadcast media from reporting on the topic, online investigative website The Ditch published leaked advice from the Attorney General. The advice, dating from December from Acting AG Rosa Fanning to Integration Minister Roderick O'Gorman, suggested that there was legal uncertainty around proposed amendments and potentially greater litigation to come from them. It appears at odds with claims made by government ministers during the lead-up to the referendum. So, should this unpublished advice have been covered more widely, and are the media moratoriums still fit for purpose? Well, joining me to discuss this, our own McNeil, journalist with The Ditch and Solidarity People Before Profit, TD Mick Barry. And I'm also joined again by broadcaster Sean O'Rourke and Fiona Sheehan from the Irish Independent. And we want you at home to have your say in our live interactive poll tonight. We're asking, should that traditional broadcast moratorium for elections now be abolished? You can vote online on virginmediatelevision.ie/vote or follow the QR code that you currently see on your screen, and we'll bring you the poll results later in the programme. Owen, I want to come to you first because it was your story on The Ditch. What can you tell me? I know you're not going to tell me your source, but what can you tell me about receiving the AG's advice and The Ditch's decision to publish it?
Yeah, look, you know, it was a fair long slog, you know, to try and get that advice. It was kind of a by any means necessary kind of thing, and took us a fair whack of work. And it was finally on Thursday we got the document, and I mean, we talked it over. You know, myself and my colleague Roman and my other colleague Polly. I mean, it was a very, very quick decision. It was well, we're obviously going to publish this, and. From there, then, you know, honestly, you know, the terms of the moratorium wasn't a consideration for us at all, one way or the other. And, you know, obviously, The Ditch isn't covered by it. Equally, we had to go through our own journalistic processes to get to a point where we were happy to publish what we published, which was just after 2 o'clock. And then, yeah, throughout the day, we did two of our own stories, and then... It was around 8 o'clock, we published the whole document in full.
Yeah, what do you think the motivation was for leaking that document? Because it is normally strategic, isn't it, leaks like this?
The motivation of how we got the document?
Yeah.
I just know that we got it.
All right, so you don't want to go into any detail as to why somebody would have thought it was a good idea to leak this particular piece of information, but the upshot was that it was leaked, and Mary Butler has said that the minister has said that it was scandalous that it was leaked. Do you agree?
I mean, like, we can get into the semantics of it. I mean, arguably it was scandalous, but if it was scandalous, it was a scandal caused by government's decision to not publish the advice in the first place. If there was no suppression, there's no need for someone like The Ditch to go and publish what we published. I mean, any kind of, and you know, there's been chatter from people like Roderick O'Gorman talking about calling for an investigation. Regina Doherty has said something similar. I mean, like, they should be looking at themselves, and they created the conditions under which we published what we published.
Fionnuala Sheehan, Roderick O'Gorman told this programme that they were prohibited from sharing that Attorney General advice with the public. What is the legal provision that prevents them from doing that?
Well, their argument is that the Attorney General's advice is confidential to Cabinet. Now, there are ways and means around that. For example, only in recent times there was advice provided by the Attorney General on a controversy that the then tarnished and now Taoiseach found himself in, and they managed to publish that. In previous referenda in the last decade around same-sex marriage and abortion, a version of the Attorney General's advice was provided in order to feed the debate. So the traditional excuse from government that we can't publish the AG's advice is kind of thrown out the door whenever it suits them. But yet on an occasion like this, it was also part of the lack of a deliberative process in this referendum compared to previous occasions. So you didn't have the pre-legislative scrutiny, you didn't have the major teasing out of the referendum proposal and any subsequent legislation in the Dáil. And this suppression of the AG's advice was part of that.
Because when we did ultimately read that AG advice, do you think that hadn't negative impact on people?
Well, actually,
did it change opinion? I mean, did it damage?
Some of it was actually supportive of the government side in terms of, like, he completely quashes any suggestion that immigration would be impacted here. It's quite a comprehensive section of the AG's advice. And that had been a debating point within the campaign, that the issue of durable relationships would allow people to get some immigration status here. Other aspects of it, though, was quite clear. There were going to be implications as a result of the passing of this referendum, despite what government was saying.
One of the difficulties with this, Sean O'Rourke, is that there was a moratorium in place. So by the time broadcasters like ourselves, RTE, News Talk, Today FM, any other local broadcaster got hold of this advice, we couldn't discuss it. We couldn't debate it because of the moratorium.
Yeah, I think until such time as Commission na Mban, which is the latter-day version of the Broadcasting Authority, has authority and sanction over whether it's the Ditch or the big social media outlets, well, the broadcasting moratorium is a kind of an anomaly, an overhang from maybe more simple times.
Has it served the public well in the past, do you think?
I think arguably it has. Again, I hate using the phrase I'm old enough to remember, but I remember being in the RTE news features area in 1982 during the first, I think it was the first of the, sorry, the it was the either the second or the third of the three elections that came together in 18 months. And a story broke and it was around town that Charlie Haughey's election agent had allegedly voted twice at separate polling stations. And there was massive pressure put on RTE to report this. Now, arguably, if that happened, and that story happened around lunchtime, if that had been broadcast at that stage, it could have had serious consequences for the outcome of the election. And Wesley Boyd, who was the then head of news, flatly refused to countenance doing anything of the sort. Social media would have had it all over the place.
And social media didn't exist back then.
Exactly.
So the fact that it does exist.
So until such time as social, as non, what we call traditional media outlets can be brought under the Broadcasting Act, those kind of restrictions, moratorium-wise, well, then it's kind of an empty formula. And also, I mean, Fionnuala's paper wouldn't have brought out an addition, but they would now, again, if it similarly happened and he had got the advice, well, they could have put it up online. So they just need to maybe modernise the approach.
But you would ultimately keep it?
If it could be managed, yes.
The idea being that it gives the electorate space and time to sort of take all the information and come to a considered judgment.
It kind of suited me when I was presenting the news at 1 on RTE that they changed the regulation and allowed you to have election coverage up to 2 p.m. on the eve of poll. I actually thought it was a better idea to just, you know, cut it off at midnight on the day before.
Mary Butler has said that, she acknowledged that there is no moratorium there for internet sites like your own, for social media, and that needs to be examined. Do you agree with Sean O'Rourke and actually Mary Butler that maybe the answer to all of this, Owen, is to extend it so everybody who's reporting is treated fairly and the same?
Like, they can absolutely extend it to places like the Ditch, and we will ignore it. Like, there's not a hope in hell that we would abide by the terms of a moratorium.
So sorry, why not?
Why would you take a different stance to other broadcasters?
I think the moratorium is paternalistic and arrogant. If we're to take it under, if we're to refer to the principles under which it was introduced, we're supposed to be all Democrats here, and it's supposed to, you know, give the electorate time to think. It's supposed to improve and enhance our democracy. We showed on Thursday that it didn't improve or enhance our democracy because you had broadcasters who couldn't. Well, I also find it interesting where, I mean, you read the wording and it's like, it says broadcasters should avoid. And it's like, honestly, I would say, I mean, when there's an election, right, government doesn't go into, like, you know, they don't pull the moratorium out. It's not a physical thing that you can go up and touch. Why not just publish, like?
So you think we should just ignore it and we should have gone ahead and debated?
I mean, that we have here. We have someone like Lisa Chambers, who is a Fianna Fáil senator, who said that the information that we published was so significant, it changed the way she voted.
Should we have?
Well, they're actually, what is the moratorium? Hmm. It's not somebody from the government sitting outside there going, oh, you can't print that. You know, it's a guideline. And the guidelines are underpinned by a code of conduct. And the code of conduct is underpinned by the Broadcasting Act. Mm. So if you guys here in Virgin Media decided that night, you know what, this is so much in the public interest, we believe it has to be published, and we can take legal advice on that. And if the commission and the man want to take us down that route, well, then so be it. That's a decision you would have had to take. Geraldine Kennedy had a High Court order against her to produce a document. And she burnt the document in breach of that High Court order because she said the public interest is not served by people finding out who leaked this important document. On a daily basis, newspapers, broadcasters, websites have to assess defamation, libel, contempt.
I'm just thinking, do we just sort of then play fast and loose with the laws here?
It's not fast. No, hold on, no. Every night of the week, you have to make a decision out in that newsroom. Is there a potential breach of the law here? In terms of defamation or contempt. So you weigh it up.
Yeah, but we do weigh it up, but we ultimately decide is to stay on the right side of the law.
Sorry, you stay on the right side of the guidelines, which said you should. Doesn't say you absolutely have to. Doesn't say you will be shut down in the morning if you don't. It says you should. And let's face it, your organisation and other broadcasters haven't done a great job at this. Let me just share this with you. The view here in this station is that the moratorium is totally outdated, and if one media organisation is allowed to cover a story and another isn't, it seems ridiculous.
Yeah, but that was the piece written by our political correspondent, Gavin Riley.
No, that's data from 2002. I wrote that myself in 2002. So it's your organisation's view that for a quarter of a century, this has been completely out of date. But if you have failed to adequately lobby the respective organisations that have been placed at that time. By the way, Commission New Man, what did they do? Brand new media organisation, all new era. All they did was photocopy the previous one. It's all actually right. Word for word the exact same one.
Mick,
was there
what
before.
Do you think of this moratorium?
I'd make two points. First of all, the moratorium seems very 20th century to me. I don't see how with internet sites and social media that you're going to be able to stop news information getting out there in the run-up to an election. And I suspect that what's going to happen at the end of the day here is that the moratorium is going to fall. The second point that I would make is that I'm seated here with a whole number of journalists who, you know, maybe think that the last minute breaking news story clinches the election. This referendum was defeated before the Ditch put that up on Friday. I think when the carers, and in particular, the people with disabilities, drew a line in the sand and, in effect, had a rebellion across the country and said, we're going to make a stand on this, demand rights and go for a no vote. I think from that moment on, this referendum was in care was defeated, and I had a knock-on onto the other one as well.
You publicly changed your mind, didn't you? You were a yes-yes vote and then you changed it to a yes-no vote. Why do you think others in the opposition didn't follow suit?
OK, well, at the start of the referendum campaign, I was yes-yes. Essentially, what I was arguing was that there's sexist language in the Constitution here that needs to be removed. I didn't like the fact that the religious right and the far right were playing a prominent role in the No campaign. But then this rebellion began among people with disabilities and with carers. And I think a public representative, as well as having a mouth on them, needs to have a good pair of ears. And myself and my colleague, Ruth Cobbager, we listened to what was happening. We engaged with people. I think we were a bit late. We only made our call on the Monday before the vote. But we said, we're changing our view and we're going to go for yes.
So did you have equal concerns, or were you just reacting to reading the tea leaves?
We had equal concerns, and we were trying to listen to what the people with disabilities were saying. And on the Monday before the vote, we issued a statement. We said we're calling for a no vote in the care referendum. And I think that others, who are in the opposition and against the government should have done the same thing, because they were aware of what was going on
too. Why did they not follow suit, do you think?
I don't know. You'd have to ask them.
We've asked many of them to come on the programme over the last couple of days, but they haven't made themselves available.
Maybe some people were embarrassed. When you're in politics, it's like you're an expert on everything and you have to always be right and so on. We didn't know how it would go for us. I'm not a flip-flopper by instinct, but there was a roar coming from the people with disabilities and the carers, and it had to be listened to by someone who would be in a socialist corner.
Was there a difficulty here, Sean, for these political parties, let's say the opposition in particular, with changing their minds on this? Because if they had changed their minds and suddenly started advocating a yes-no or no-no vote, people like me and you and Fionnán and Ewan would have probably said, you're just being populist. You're changing your mind because you're reading the electorate and you don't want to be seen against them.
Or, as Mick said, because they're listening to the electorate. Mm. I think the real problem lay in the way the government went about bringing forward these changes in the first place, by rushing it through the Dáil, not being open to any kind of amendments, forgetting about the pre-legislative scrutiny, and kind of assuming that everybody would go for it. And to an extent, they were lulled into that sense false sense of security by the way the opposition parties kind of hummed and hawed and all said, well, it should have gone further, but really, it's what's there and we're going to vote for it. But I think, yet again, a very hard lesson has been learned about referenda. But the government is in the happy position that over a four-week period, I think there are only two sitting days at the Dáil. If you exclude this week, when they're all away selling Ireland around the world. Next week, I think there's a two-day session, and then they're off for 2 weeks for the Easter break.
And they'll hope by the time they come back, we'll have all have forgotten about it.
A completely different country by then.
I just want to bring people the result there. Should the traditional broadcast moratorium for elections be abolished? 66% of people say yes. Very, very briefly, Owen, do you think this referendum has long-term impacts?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm not a constitutional law expert. In fact, if I'd actually Rossa Fanning, who lectured me in constitutional law, would probably be the first man to say that. So
me too, actually.
I leave the kind of serious legal academic analysis to people better placed. But I mean, certainly I think what we published showed, I think, that government, whatever word you want to use, misled, lied, wasn't truthful with the electorate. It also, for me, it kind of made a bit of a joke of this thing of relying on the Attorney General's advice when they don't. Maybe the public won't accept those kind of excuses.
Okay, look, we're going to leave that there for now. My thanks to Sean O'Rourke, Fionnán Sheehan, Owen McNeill and Mick Barry for coming in to me. After the break, we're going live to New York as former socialite and committed sex offender Ghislaine Maxwell seeks to overturn her 20-year prison sentence. Stay with us. You're very welcome back. Well, a New York court has heard arguments by a lawyer for Ghislaine Maxwell appealing her 2021 conviction for sex trafficking. The former socialite is serving a 20-year sentence for recruiting and grooming several underage girls for the late financier Jeffrey Epstein to molest. New York correspondent Will Denislow is standing by with the latest on the appeal. Will, thank you for joining us. Her lawyers now are arguing that this plea agreement secured by Jeffrey Epstein in 2007 in Florida should have prevented her from being prosecuted. What's her reasoning behind that?
That's absolutely right. This was a plea deal that was agreed to by Jeffrey Epstein's team and prosecutors in South Florida over 15 years ago. As we know, that was superseded. Jeffrey Epstein died in a New York prison cell whilst awaiting trial himself back in 2019. That death was ruled a suicide. Ghislaine Maxwell's team say that that plea deal should very much apply to her. We've heard from her legal team speaking at this appeals proceeding. They say the fact that that deal has not been honoured, they say that is a dagger in the heart of trust.
And they also are questioning the jury and indeed brought up an issue of juror misconduct. What are they basing that on?
That's right. This actually came out after Ghislaine Maxwell was convicted on these five counts, including sex trafficking, sexually abusing young girls, grooming them for the late financier. And what transpired after the trial is that one of the jurors didn't previously disclose that he himself was a victim of sexual abuse when he was a child. The message from Ghislaine Maxwell's team is that that should have been grounds for a dismissal, that he couldn't be impartial during that trial. That is why that while they are calling for this case to be dismissed in its totality, they say if that isn't the case, there should at least be a retrial on those grounds.
That's the defence cases. That's what her lawyers are saying. What about the prosecution? How have they reacted to this?
When it comes to the case with the Florida plea deal, a very strong rebuttal, as you might expect, from the prosecution, essentially saying there was nothing in that Florida arrangement all those years ago that specifically names Ghislaine Maxwell as one of the co-defendants, so shouldn't be necessarily included in Jeffrey Epstein's plea deal. They also say there was nothing in that agreement that applied nationwide, that maybe that was an agreement for South Florida. There was nothing to say that it didn't have national ramifications. It was, of course, an argument that was successful when Ghislaine Maxwell ultimately went to trial several years ago. They're hoping it'll be successful again this time in front of a New York appeals court.
All right. Well, Denislow, thank you for bringing us that update. Well, that is it from us here on The Tonight Show. Our programme is available as a podcast on all major platforms, and you can also now find us on Instagram and on TikTok, Tonight VMTV. But from all of the late team here, good night and do. Take care.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.